From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
But I can tell you this, I don't believe you can find any evidence of the fact that I had changed government policy solely because of a contribution.
Maybe not solely, but what is the role of money in politics? Who's paying? Who's asking? Who's benefiting? When will it stop? Mother Jones editor Jeffrey Klein joins us for a free-ranging conversation. And we remember the life of legendary Caribbean politician Michael Manley.
You know, this is what the capitalist system applied unthinkingly and unquestioningly to Jamaica did. 13.6% unemployment in 1962. You have 10 years of independence. You have a government that believed totally in the capitalist system, that operated the capitalist system. I have no doubt did it sincerely. It's not a quarrel with them. It's a quarrel with the system.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Republican leaders pledged yesterday to find out what the White House knew about an FBI investigation into alleged Chinese attempts to buy influence in American politics last year. Leon Panetta, White House chief of staff at the time, said his office knew nothing about it. Panetta and his successor Erskine Bowles also mounted a defense of the Clinton administration's aggressive fundraising activities before the 1996 election, saying they were forced to collect a lot of money to stop the Republican agenda from winning. As they have for weeks, campaign finance scandals have dominated the television news programs. The chief topic yesterday was a story in the Washington Post that the FBI warned six members of Congress they were targets of an illegal effort by China to funnel laundered money to influence lawmakers. The article, quoting government officials, said investigators had conclusive evidence that Chinese funds entered the country last year, although it remains uncertain whether any of the money reached congressional or presidential campaigns. ABC News reported later yesterday that China established a $1.8 million fund to influence U.S. elections and that as many as 30 members of Congress were warned they might be approached to receive illicit contributions. One senator, California's Dianne Feinstein, confirmed through a spokesperson she was briefed last June about the Chinese money laundering threat. The other five were not identified by the Post, but ABC reported that Senator Barbara Boxer, another Democrat from California, was among them. And Republicans are renewing their call for an independent prosecutor to look into campaign finance improprieties, the latest demand following the reports of the alleged plot by China to funnel illegal campaign contributions. The Washington Post is quoting unidentified government officials as saying that China did work up plans to spend almost $2 million. Republican leaders say they want to find out just what happened. Administration officials already say they weren't informed by the FBI. The chairman of the Senate committee considering Anthony Lake's nomination to head the CIA wants to question Lake's former staff of the National Security Council and might subpoena them. Senator Richard Shelby, appearing yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, said Senate Intelligence Committee staff plan to talk with NSC employees about voluntarily answering questions about any contact the NSC had with Democratic fundraisers being investigated by the Justice Department. If they refuse, Shelby said, nobody would be subpoenaed until after he consulted the full committee. Just as investigators are trying to determine whether fundraisers passed illegal foreign money to President Clinton's reelection campaign. Some medical professionals treating sick Persian Gulf War veterans claim they've contracted symptoms of Gulf War illness and say the mysterious disease could pose a public health threat. This according to the Los Angeles Times today. The doctors, nurses, and researchers say they're suffering from fatigue, fever, aches, rashes, and respiratory problems generally associated with the mysterious syndrome. The Los Angeles Times reported this in their Sunday edition. Everyone in this office has had Gulf War illness, Garth Nicholson, a biochemist at the nonprofit Institute for Molecular Medicine, told the paper. He said, I lost four teeth and had part of my lower jaw removed. Nicholson has claimed to have found a genetically altered version of mycoplasma, a microorganism known to sometimes cause disease, in the blood of half of the several hundred sick veterans he's tested. He says antibiotics have successfully treated some of them. Government investigators express skepticism and say they found little evidence to support the claim that Gulf War illnesses are contagious. Peru's government and the rebels holding 72 hostages are poised to restart face-to-face talks today after negotiations to end the 83-day crisis are abruptly called off last week. Peruvian newspapers and radio said mediators and rebels at a two-and-a-half-hour meeting yesterday set the stage for talks to resume between the government and the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, known as the MRTA. And four employees at Walt Disney World filed a lawsuit on Friday against the entertainment giant, accusing Walt Disney Company of racial discrimination. According to the lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, four African-American employees working at the company's Florida theme park or related hotels or resorts were denied the opportunity for promotions, raises, and bonuses that are typically given to white employees. The lawsuit, which is seeking class action status, also claims Disney retaliates against African-American employees by, quote, intimidating and threatening them, diminishing their work responsibilities, and terminating their employment. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Before we move into today's show, we had been running for the last 2 weeks commentaries by death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal. All of those commentaries are now available in text and audio format on Pacifica Radio's worldwide webpage. Also on the website are a host of related materials, including press releases and information related to the Abu-Jamal case. The address you can go to on the internet is www.pacifica.org. It's a great website, so check it out. The address again, www.pacifica.org. You'll also find updates about the controversy at Temple University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, again, which canceled its contract with Pacifica Radio after learning of Democracy Now!'s decision to play Abu-Jamal's commentaries. And also, folks, Democracy Now! Itself is online, and you can find it by going to our same website, www.pacifica.org. We may be banned in Pennsylvania at this point, that's in terms of broadcasting, but we're not banned on the internet, and so people all over the country can hear Democracy Now! Well, on with the show as we move into our first segment on money in politics.
One boy, boy for sale, he's going cheap, only 7 guineas, that's all that amounts. Small boy, rather pale, from lack of sleep, feed him gruel dinners, stop him getting stout.
The Clinton administration was once again rocked this past week by more campaign finance scandals. First Vice President Al Gore had to defend himself against charges that he used facilities at the White House to actively raise funds for the Clinton-Gore 1996 presidential campaign. The allegations earned him the sobriquet Solicitor-in-Chief. Then it was revealed that Hillary Clinton's chief of staff, Maggie Williams, received a $50,000 check from a campaign donor in her White House office. The scandals prompted President Clinton himself to hold a news conference to refute the charges of impropriety, saying that he is not one boy for sale. Of course, that's our ad-libbing of what he had to say at that press conference. So let's hear what the president himself did say at his Friday news conference.
Mr. President, we learned this week that the vice president solicited campaign contributions in the White House and that the first lady's chief of staff accepted a $50,000 campaign contribution in the White House. This comes on the heels of news about White House sleepovers and White House coffees for big money donors. You, sir, promised to have the most ethical administration in history. How does all of this square with that?
Well, first of all, let's take them one by one. I don't believe that they undermine the case. But let me begin by saying there were problems in the fundraising in 1996, which have been well identified, and the Democratic Party commissioned its own audit, did a review, made the results public, and took appropriate action. I think that is very important, and I'm proud of that. Second thing I want to say is I thought the Vice President did a good job of explaining what he did and why, and explaining exactly what he intended to do in the future.
President, in your zeal for funds during the last campaign, didn't you put the Vice President and Maggie and all the others in your administration topside in a very vulnerable position.
I disagree with that. How are we vulnerable? Because only vulnerable if you think it is inherently bad to raise funds. And you believe that these transactions are between people who are almost craven. I mean, I don't agree with that. Maggie Williams, in this case, was completely passive. She didn't ask someone to come in and give her a check. And she had no reason to believe there's anything wrong with it, with the check involved. She just simply did what the regulation explicitly provides for, which is to pass it on. Now, in the case of the vice president, he can speak for himself. But I have to tell you, we knew what we were facing. We knew no matter what happened, we would be badly outspent. We believed in what we stood for, and we were, frankly, from time to time, we were surprised we had as many folks who were willing to stick with us as they were. But we are proud of the fact that within the limits of the law, we worked hard to raise money so that we could get our message out there and we would not be buried, literally buried, by the amount of money that the other side had at their disposal.
I'm going to ask your forbearance because this question is a little bit long, but this is about Johnny Chung, the person who gave the check to Maggie Williams. In April of 95, about a month after he gave that check, he came in here to the White House. He brought in five Chinese officials. Someone on your staff sent a memo to the National Security Council saying that you were not certain you'd want photos of you with these people floating around. I wanted to ask you why you were worried about that, and also why, after a highly knowledgeable NSC official wrote back that he was a hustler who will continue to make efforts to bring in his friends into contact with the present First Lady, and whose clients might not always be in favor of business ventures the president would support. Why did he keep getting back in here? What was your relationship to him? And he now says that it was at least implicit, if not explicit, that he would get this access for the money he gave.
Well, first of all, you asked me two questions, really.
Four.
Why did I? Well, I'll answer the two I can remember, then if I don't, Susie, you're going to ask again. I just had, as I have said before on this question of White House access, we did not have an adequate system here. I assumed, wrongly as it turned out, that there were kind of established procedures which were sort of handed on from administration to administration that had nothing to do with whoever happened to be here about that controlled and developed and access. And I was wrong about that. So that's what I assumed generally was in place until we became aware that they weren't. But on this particular day, I just had an instinct that maybe whatever the rules were, that we didn't maybe know enough about these folks to know whether that there should be a picture there. I didn't assume anything negative about them. I just thought that we just didn't know. Now, with regard to the memo about Mr. Chung, I can't answer that question because I never saw it, and no one ever told me it had been written, and I don't know who did see it. So I really can't answer that whole cluster of questions because the first I ever knew such a memo had been written was when it was discussed in the public domain. I did not know that. I had no reason to believe that there was any problem there.
Relationship with Mr. Chung. How did you come to know him? How did he get into your office and write you letters that you replied to? There's lots of record of that.
Well, I like to think we're pretty good about replying to our letters, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't remember how I met him, but I think I met him at some Democratic Party event. I'm sure that's where I met him. I didn't have a relationship with him prior to my becoming president, to the best of my knowledge.
Mr. President, you again today, Vice President Gore the other day, and your staffs have repeatedly told us that no laws were broken in the Lincoln bedroom issue, in the phone calls for donations, in Maggie Williams accepting and then passing along the donation to the DNC. But cumulatively, Mr. President, what are your thoughts on the propriety and the appearance of all of these various actions?
Well, let's take them one at a time. The Vice President has said that he believes he should, if he makes further fundraising calls as opposed to attending fundraising events, he should not make them from his office, even if it is paid for with a political credit card. I have said that I believe Maggie Williams thinks, in view of the environment in which we now are, that even though there is an explicit regulation on this, right on point on this, that, you know, what she probably wishes she had said and what I expect future employees to say is, look, I can take this, it is legal, but we're not going to do it this way. You have to mail it in or you have to take it in yourself. On the third thing, you know, I just have a different view of this than you do. I have done something no president has ever done. I gave you a list of the people that spent the night in the White House. And it shows that a relatively small percentage of them, about 1 in 9, were people that I met in the course of running for president, who supported me for president, who either gave me contributions or also helped to raise money for me. You know, the people that did that, I'm grateful to them for doing that. I appreciate the fact that they helped me in that campaign in 92. This job, even when you're traveling, can be a very isolating job. Usually when you travel someplace, you go someplace, you stay a little while, you turn around and leave. If you go to these fundraisers, they're on the coffees, for example, I'm the one that's most responsible, or for the dinners out, you know, the fundraising dinners. I get frustrated going to meetings and going where all you do is shake hands with somebody, or you take a picture, no words ever change. You never know what somebody's got on their mind, or they never get a chance to talk to you. You never have any real human contact. Now, I look for ways to have genuine conversations with people. I learn things when I listen to people. But I can tell you this. I don't believe you can find any evidence of the fact that I had changed government policy solely because of a contribution.
President Clinton, in his news conference on Friday, in that last sentence, I don't believe you can find any evidence of the fact that I had changed government policy solely because of a contribution. Joining us right now to talk about these issues is Jeffrey Klein. He is the editor of Mother Jones Magazine, based in San Francisco. It's a monthly publication. Mother Jones has taken a leading role over the last 2 years in uncovering campaign contributions to both the Republican and Democratic parties. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Jeffrey.
Morning, Amy.
Well, why don't we start with that very last point?
You know, you could have used as your opening music, I think your choice was impeccable. My second choice would have been a funny thing happened on the way to the presidency, because so much of this is comic in my mind. So much of it is transparently fraudulent and not just legalistic, but there's something absurd in all their defenses. But you're right. The last point was solely, which leads a mathematician to say, you mean it was an element, but it wasn't the sole element. That is, the money helped you make your decisions on policy, but other things came into account, too, like perhaps on a rare day, the value of the policy for the American public might have entered into the discussion.
Now, just before that, President Clinton was asked by Rita Braver about the question of Mr. Chung and the campaign contributions that he got.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that was great.
Talking about he brought in 5 Chinese officials who ended up at one of the radio broadcasts that President Clinton does every Saturday morning, and that President Clinton responded that just by instinct, he's not sure why, but just by instinct, he said that maybe we don't know enough about these folks to know whether there should be a picture there, not whether they should be in the White House, but whether there should be a picture there.
Yeah, it's really great that he has this sixth sense, but it really goes to the fraudulence of the whole argument. Let's take his long answer about how we could feel his pain about being isolated as president and how much he disliked just shaking people's hands and having a photo taken. Well, I went to the opening, the kickoff of the Gore Clinton fundraiser out here in Northern California. And it is true that if you went to the photo op part, you didn't really get as much contact. You had to pay $25,000 to go to the reception photo op before the $1,000 lunch. So if you wanted to have this close personal contact with the president about policy, then you had to pay $50,000. That's what happened in the hour before the lunch. And if you wanted to pay a lot more money, then you went up into the hotel suite before that. So basically what he's saying is, who does he get his close personal contact with? The people who are willing to pay a lot of money. What do those people want? They want something back. And the more we go up this corruption chain, the more he's in place with people who are essentially going to use the good offices of the President of the United States. In some way, I really am... You know, I'm cautious about descending into this language, but it's so obvious to me that he's sort of become, well, if you want to be modest about it, he's the geisha in chief, or if you want to be immodest, he's the call girl in chief. He's told his officials, I want to get elected no matter what. And there's some language in one of his previous answers that addresses that point. You know, he said we were going to be buried. And that was the mood, not in 92, but in 94 after the Gingrich victory. And he went and he hired people. You know, some of the officials are obvious who he hired, and he said, do whatever it takes. And what do these people do? They go out and do whatever it takes, and they get the Johnny Chungs of the world and the Wangs of the world, who are, you know, with not only was Chang warned, a warning came through, but with Wang, very serious warnings came back that this guy might have ties to the Lippo Group, and the Lippo Group, who Clinton knew from the Arkansas days, had very serious business needs that they wanted.
The banking conglomerate from Indonesia.
Yes, pardon. Yeah, the Riadis. And I mean, they have many business interests, but perhaps their main one is opening up ventures in China. And they want the Clinton administration, at the very least, to look the other way on human rights abuses. But they want some other things as well.
Jeffrey, I have to interrupt for a minute because we do have to break. But when we come back, we'll find out what else they want and how different are these men, people like Johnny Chung, people like John Huang, from people like Dick Cheney and Henry Kissinger and George Shultz, also lobbying for the Chinese government. We don't hear their names brought up very much. But then I want to also talk about Vice President Gore and the significance of his having to hold that hasty news conference yesterday because of the charges against him. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're talking to Jeffrey Klein, editor of Mother Jones Magazine, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a minute, we go back to Jeffrey Klein. But it seems that each week the campaign finance scandals in Washington are spreading. The latest allegations are that China took advantage of our corrupt system of campaign finance by making campaign contributions, at least trying to buy influence with certain members of Congress. Well, as Ralph Nader says, a fish rots from the head down. In recent months, we've reported how President Clinton used the Lincoln bedroom as a money motel and invited wealthy donors for coffee and conversation as a way of raising a record amount of dough for the 1996 campaign. A lot of listeners call us and say they feel left out and that they're angry. Would you like to have an equal opportunity to sit down with President Clinton and share your ideas for a better America? Do you think the president should care as much about your concerns, whether or not you have money, as he apparently does for the big donors? Well, we certainly do. And we're offering you a chance to send a powerful message to the White House. Democracy Now! Is encouraging you to send an old coffee mug to the White House with a letter to President Clinton asking him to invite you over for coffee talk. Or if you want, we can send it for you. You can call our 800 number, that's 1-800-735-0230, and order a Democracy Now! Mug sent in your name by charging it on your credit card. So go grab a pencil, and we'll give out that number again in just a second. We're calling this our Coffee, Tea, and Me campaign. If you call our 800 number, we send the White House a white mug which says Democracy Now! In red and blue lettering on one side. The other side says, Dear President Clinton, coffee, tea, and me? And here's the letter that would be sent with your name on it. It says, Dear President Clinton, I've heard you've invited big donors, corporate executives, bankers, and arms merchants to have coffee and conversation with you at the White House. I may not have much money, but I do have serious concerns about public policy in our country's future. I still believe in government of, by, and for the people, and I care deeply about the state of democracy in America. I welcome the equal opportunity to share my thoughts with you in person. Coffee, tea, and me. And then it goes on to say, Democracy Now!, sincerely, your name. And at the bottom, please send my invitation to, and it gives your name and address. So if you'd like to participate in Democracy Now!'s Coffee, Tea, and Me campaign to send a message to President Clinton, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 anytime today, and you can have a Democracy Now! Mug and personalized letter sent to the president making a statement about big money, corporate money, and how it's destroying our democracy, something we hear over and over again from our listeners. And we wanted to give you a vehicle to let President Clinton know exactly how you feel. I should also say, if you still have your pencil in hand, that if you want to find out more information on campaign contributions and you want to see what Mother Jones is up to, we're just about to go back to Jeffrey Klein, editor of Mother Jones Magazine. You can find out about the top 400 donors to the Republican and Democratic parties, the issue that's coming up next for Mother Jones. And you can call their 800 number at 1-800-GET-MOJO. That's 1-800-GETMOJO. So you can take action today as well. Well, Jeffrey Klein, I left you with a lot of questions just before the break. Why don't we first go to the issue of Vice President Gore and how significant it is that he was on the hot seat this past week.
I think it was the most significant development of the last week because Gore is now in play as a candidate. In some ways, in very major ways, Clinton has been, as they say in the market, discounted already as a liar. People reelected him knowing he was a liar and a cheat, but they felt like he was a likable liar and cheat, and he was probably going to do a better job than the other guy. So more and more stuff is going to come out, and I think it is going to imperil his very presidency, but he has a lot of room because it's already been accepted in his public image. Gore's public image is somebody who's honest and ethical, and so these disclosures, and there will be more, will go to the core of his strength. And then what will you be left with? That Al Gore is charming? I don't think so. And so he's going to have a risk of seeing his whole political career evaporate before him. And then something very interesting occurs. It's going to occur with other people as well. He has to consider whether he's going to, you know, file for a divorce or at least do a trial separation. And that will make Clinton very angry. And you could see Clinton went out of his way to defend Gore now. These things have overtones, by the way, for me, of Hillary's I stand by my man kind of discussions, because Clinton now has to keep an increasing number of people in close to his group. If one of these people break, he's in major league trouble, because as in a divorce situation, once somebody splits, all the stuff that was kept inside of the household then pours out, and there's much more that's inside the White House household.
Like what?
Well, let's just look at the corruption chain that we're seeing. I personally think the coffees, when Clinton says they were rather pedestrian affairs, he said at that press conference, he was in a way telling the truth, because he's just tickling those people there. He has no particular intention of following through on the policies that they said, and that's the $25,000 and $50,000 crowd, and he's just trying to give them the impression that their voice matters. But I was told by a very senior official inside the White House that under $250,000, you really don't even register on the policy radar. So it's the people we need to look to who are giving more than just the coffees. Now, those people, you have some big vanity money in there, some people who want to show off that they can get the president to come to a dinner. And some of these people, like David Geffen, for example, buy four dinners, and they have all the tickets, and then they show corporate America they're big players. Geffen's, the 10th richest man in America. But above those people, above the Geffens, who are in there for power or vanity money, are highly corrupt people who say, gee, this is a way that I can, you know, buy policy. Especially if you're a foreigner, you say, hey, in Taiwan or in China, the way we do business is we give a cut to the guy who's doing the deal. And we're in for some major league exposés on what these people got back, because many of them don't care about photo ops. They want the exact opposite. They want them to be stealth contributions, and they want the reward to be stealth. And it's those hardball players that will make this scandal into, I believe, in some ways, I'm not going to say it's going to occur, because we have a big problem of who's going to impeach the impeachers, because Congress is definitely involved at just the depth that the White House is. But in some ways, I think this is a worse than a Watergate scandal already, because we're not talking about one maniacal individual driving a process. And Clinton's remove from the process, his deniability, which in some cases he probably preserves, shows you how bad it is, because the whole system is in place to manipulate him. And that's really what's at stake here.
I want to go back for a second when you talked about the middlemen, because that's very serious. The people who are making these deals, who are actually profiting off them, not just being the emissaries, but taking cuts.
Yes. Well, let's just, and I'm going to be a slight bit cautious here, because this is exposés I'm actually working on today and this week for our 400 issue, which you mentioned. But
feel free to share your exposés here.
Well, I'll just, I hope there's some investigative reporters out there who will just follow the logic, because it's a pretty simple logic. When you shake hands with the Chinese government, or when you shake hands with the Taiwanese government. Incidentally, there was a boon for the fundraisers here for both parties, because Taiwan and China are in competition. It's a little like the telecommunications bill. When you can get two big parties in competition, then you can shake down both of them. But you have to arrange middlemen to go in between. Okay, I'll give you one middleman. His name is Mark Middleton. Mark Middleton was working for Mac McClarty in the White House. All of a sudden, he gets discharged from his job in the White House, and he's now introducing himself to these various fundraisers as a man who does private business, but incidentally, he also does the president's business. So his introduction already is, I'm in private business, but I also do the president's business. And then he's talking to all these potentates or really representatives from the various tyrants, the Suhartos and the Chinese military and so on. He's talking to them about doing deals, and they're saying, American representative of the American president wants to do a deal with me. Okay, this is how we do deals in my country. I'm going to set the terms. I'm going to put the bribe involved. I'm not saying Middleton got the bribe, but he's exposing himself in the White House to the way the business is done in other countries. And he's also saying, as Clinton himself admitted, he's saying, we're going to be buried if we don't raise this money. There's another thing that Clinton said that I think is a good investigative reporter would find. I'm obviously not telling you the thing I have, but I'm looking for it. So all your listeners should go listening for this particular point. There was in place a checks and balance system to audit the checks that came in to any White House campaign. It was in place for many years. And Clinton said yesterday, I don't know if he used the newt word frankly, he did in one of the clips you did, and always when politicians say frankly, a big lie is about to occur. But so he,
least they're saying that they're not being frank about anything else they're saying.
No, usually frankly is the tip off. I always, or to be honest. To be honest is even better when you get to be honest. So he used the frankly word, and he was shocked. He was absolutely shocked that this checks and balance system to audit the checks was dropped. Now, you've got to be pretty naive to think that a check and balance system gets dropped. Somebody removed that. Find out who removed that check and balance system, who said, hey, we have got to get the cops out of here, or even the auditors out of here, or Price Waterhouse out of here, because we're going to be putting stuff through here we want nobody to look at. Find that person, and this whole thing unravels, because that person under pressure will tell you who directed them to do it and why.
We're talking to Jeffrey Klein, and he's editor of Mother Jones Magazine. Back to Gore for a minute.
Yeah.
You have a lot of people who will benefit if Gore goes down. You've got
Bill
Bradley.
Including many Democrats.
That's right. You've got Dick Gephardt. In
yes.
fact, Gephardt is a major recipient of Lipo Group funds, isn't he?
Yes, I don't know the exact amount, but let's just take that again in the important point you raised. You've noticed now how Congress, both in the House and the Senate, has narrowed the scope of their various investigations. They want unlimited amounts of money, and they want it, you know, basically stamped for Clinton's vital organs only. They want to just go after Clinton, and they're trying to circumscribe the investigation. So they're basically saying, let's investigate the Lippo Group, but only their checks to officials whose first names start with B and second names start with C. You know, they're saying, not us. We don't want anything looking into anything other than the presidential campaign. We don't want to look into any fundamental problems. So, again, the key problem, and I'm going to mention the I word here, the key problem with an well, let's go to the special prosecutor word first. The main hesitation on a special prosecutor, they're going to try and narrow the scope of what they'd look into. It's dangerous for them. But on the impeachment word, the I word, the main problem here is who would impeach the impeachers, because they don't want foreign money and its ties to the American government being investigated. Because foreign money, and this is what's one of the, you asked me what's different between previous administrations. The key thing that will be different for the American public is if you find, and I'm quite certain you will, that foreign governments were actively manipulating the election, then you're into treason areas, and you will now then get the fury of conservatives, because real conservatives, of which there are very few among the Republican leadership, but real conservatives, of which there are quite a few in the American population, I mean, they outnumber progressives at least 2-1, they're going to be outraged. They're going to say, hold on a second, it's my government. What are you doing letting these foreign governments manipulate things? And then you have the possibility of a coalition between progressives and conservatives. Now, mind you, you're lacking leadership on both sides, and you have historic opposition between the two. But I believe it would be in the interest of the country for these two large ideological groups to come together. I think they both have deep ideological alliances on this point, and form a coalition that would overcome the common corruption in Congress and the White House.
And yet, do you see it going in that direction? And of course, ultimately, that could lead to impeachment. When you have a new Harris poll out that says 2/3 of respondents say they see no difference between Republicans and Democrats and how much they're influenced by campaign contributors, and in other polls that campaign finance is not a major issue for Americans today.
Well, I said this when we were covering the Gingrich hearings. I view these polls differently than anyone I've ever talked to. But I have a very strong sense that the first question you said, or the first polling answer you gave, is the key one. They see no difference. So right now, they're disgusted. I think it'd be really wrong to underestimate the repulsion that the American public feels on both sides of the ideological divide. But because they see no leadership telling them that their disgust can be catalyzed into action, then they're just laying back and they're saying, I can't be interested. What does that can't be interested mean? It means my life is busy, my life is frustrating, and I can't afford to put time and mental energy and my hopes into something where I don't feel like a change is going to occur. So once they have leadership and candidates and somebody who they trust to do this, I think you're going to find they're tremendously interested. I think that'll happen likely on a state level first. I've predicted this now for 4 years, ever since Clinton got elected. Some state is going to break out with some governor or some senator who's going to run on a La Follette-like ticket. It could be a Republican. And they're going to say, hey, the way we do business now is absolutely wrong, and this is my issue. And when I get elected, I'm going to change the system. And they're going to run on a sort of anti-Huffington campaign. They're going to come forward and saying, here's exactly my money. Here are exactly my limits. They're going to model this behavior, and they're going to win. And that's all politicians care about. And they're going to see the guy in Wisconsin or wherever, whatever state it happens, win. And then other politicians will start saying, God, this is a winning technique. And that's how I think reform will sweep into Washington, not from the people who are already there. Because after all, the system's main benefit is to the incumbents.
So you don't think it's going to come from Fred Thompson, the senator who's going to be leading the investigation in the Senate?
I think he's going to do a marvelous job. It's not going to be like you and I were getting 15 minutes notice on the Gingrich hearings when they were going to occur. He's going to give, like, since he's a movie star, we're going to get advance billings 2 months in advance. We're going to get videotapes of, we're going to get pins, we're going to get, you know, and then we're going to major publicity campaigns in Variety and so on. But no, he was a lobbyist himself. Fred Thompson was a lobbyist. He knows the nature of the game. He's probably debating inside how much of a reformer he can appear to be, because we're getting a preview in his mind of the 2000 presidential race, which is between him and Gore. And that's what his hearing is
both
all about.
Both from Tennessee.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Jeffrey Klein, for joining us. And don't worry, folks, Jeffrey will be back. He will be a regular contributor on Democracy Now!, not in the Clinton or Gingrich sense, but in the idea sense.
Hey, we made a deal about that. That was 50 grand, I thought.
Dealing with the issue of money in politics. And if you'd like to find out more about what Mother Jones is doing on the issue, the 400 major donors to both parties, you can check out their website. It's their next issue. Their website, you can call 1-800-GET-MOJO. That's 1-800-GET-MOJO. And don't forget about our offer, what we're trying to do right now around the issue of taking action around money and politics. And that is sending a mug with a message to the White House. So if you'd like to participate in Democracy Now!'s Coffee, Tea, and Me campaign and send that message to President Clinton, you can call our 800 number, either send your own mug or call our 800 number, and we'll send one for you with a personalized message. You can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You know the big donors do it, the corporate executives, the bankers, and the arms merchants. Why can't you have coffee and conversation with President Clinton? He did say he's lonely, that he feels isolated. This may be a chance to connect. You can call 1-800-735-0230. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we're going to shift gears and go down to the Caribbean to look at a major political figure there who died this past week. We'll be looking at Michael Manley. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Flags are flying at half-mast across Jamaica this weekend as the country mourns the death of former Prime Minister Michael Manley. A legendary figure in Caribbean politics, Manley died on Thursday night at his home after a long battle with cancer. He was 72 years old. Michael Manley was a member of the leading Jamaican political family. He was Prime Minister from 1972 to 1980, leading the country away from its traditional orientation towards the needs of the U.S. and British corporations, and pursuing socialist and nationalist policies. He was ousted after a CIA-backed destabilization campaign, but Manley once again returned to power from 1989 to 1992. This time, however, he adopted policies in line with the IMF, the World Bank, and the U.S. government's desires. We're joined right now by Dr. Clive Thomas, a professor of economics and director of the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Guyana, who's followed Michael Manley very closely over the years, not to mention his own leader, who died within 24 hours of Michael Manley, and that was Chetty Jagan. Dr. Clive Thomas, why don't we start with Michael Manley and tell us, who was this man?
Well, I think Michael Manley represents a type of leadership in the Caribbean that has become fewer and fewer as the years has gone by. He was the old-style colonial liberator. He struggled for the independence of Jamaica. He struggled for the wider independence of the Caribbean. But he also sought to take that further and try to liberate the masses of the people and to put in place social and economic programs that would lead to their full emancipation. He was never quite successful in that, but he represents a type of leadership that has, I think, faded from the Caribbean scene within the past two decades.
Dr. Thomas, can you describe the platform that Michael Manley ran on when he first became prime minister in 1972? And can you then describe why the U.S. government, particularly the Central Intelligence Agency, disliked him so much?
The platform he ran on was basically the platform of the People's National Party that his father headed. His father was a politician that led the charge for independence in Jamaica, and he more or less inherited the mantle. Some might say this was the dynastic connection in the leadership that led the succession from father to son. But he himself had carved out an independent place in Jamaican politics, and I think the platform that he came to power on and struggled for was one that would bring a sort of what we call in that time social democracy to Jamaica. Remember that the PNP is part of a larger international grouping of left-leaning parties that we in Europe would call labor-type parties, and he belonged to the social democratic grouping of political parties, and he wanted to bring a more populist program of social advancement to Jamaica. I think because of this, he did not take any instructions or tried not to take instructions from the United States as regards his relationships with other countries pursuing similar paths in the non-aligned movement of the time. Arising out of that, he developed a fairly close relationship with Cuba, which, as you know, is the next-door neighbor of Jamaica. And I think this added fuel to the concerns of the Central Intelligence Agency and the United States government at the height of the Cold War, and fueled a lot of suspicion that led to, being sure, both some very covert actions that in the end he himself compounded by mistakes and misjudgments that he made internally, and eventually led to his downfall in 1980.
How did Manley lose power in 1980?
Well, it was a long, bitter election. In fact, we usually have a statement in the Caribbean that we don't only want free and fair elections, we want elections free from fear as well. And it is symbolized by the events of that election in 1980. It was a bitter struggle. Nearly 1,000 people were killed during the course of the political campaign. And on a per capita basis, might be one of the most deadly so-called peaceful democratic elections ever held in the history of this world. So this was a very, very bitter period. There was sharp ideological divisions. His main rival and opponent, Edward Seaga, who won the elections, took up a very rightist and very pro-market stance against what he called his statism and his socialist orientation. He won friends and allies with the American establishment and used that, I think, to good effect. At the same time, Manley's policies, although popular in the beginning, were becoming increasingly undermined by his inability to manage the social change that he had advocated. There was disenchantment among a lot of the supporters. This led to camps being developed within Jamaica that marked sharp separations between those who supported the government and those who were against the government. And this was the seeds of the violence, I think, that eventually emerged and dominated the election campaign of 1980.
What role did the United States play in his downfall?
Well, one has to be frank and admit that the United States government wanted him to lose in 1980. This was the Cold War period. This was the period in which American government sought desperately within this region to ensure that they got governments that were more supportive of them than otherwise. And I think that they did play an active role. He's alleged that the CIA was involved in covert operations in Jamaica. He's alleged that they took very harsh stance, the IMF and other institutions, in relation to Jamaica at the bidding of the United States government. He also alleges that the investors in Jamaica were hesitant about investing because they were being guided by the belief held out by the Americans that if they held their hands for a little while, a different government would come to power and their opportunities for, you know, successful investments would be improved. And I think there's quite a bit of truth in all of that. I think the Americans definitely played in that period a very active part in the eventual demise of the Manley government in 1980.
Michael Manley was reelected 9 years later in 1989. In what ways did he change?
I think he changed quite a bit. He had adjusted to the realities of the end of the Cold War, or the almost end of the Cold War at that point in time. He recognized that there was no longer a system in which two rival hegemonic powers were seeking dominance. There was a period in which there were no longer two rival ideologies seeking for dominance. And I think that he adjusted and tried to adapt the system to meet the neoliberal requirements of the time.
What about Michael Manley's relationship with Fidel Castro? How was it the time that you said mistakes were made, and how did it change into his second term when he was more accommodating toward the United States?
Yes, I think you have to recognize that the Jamaican government, even in the period when there were different administrations, had always maintained diplomatic contact and diplomatic relations with Cuba. I think this is explained by the close historical ties between the Jamaican population and the Cuban population. So that even though there was a difference between the very first period and the second, Manley himself did not lead Jamaica in the direction of breaking diplomatic relations with Cuba. They still maintained diplomatic contact, and the relationship became a lot more of a working relationship within a broader Caribbean context. What he tried to do, and what other Caribbean countries, particularly in the English-speaking Caribbean, tried to do, was to promote a broad-based grouping of Caribbean countries that would involve Cuba as part of a wider Caribbean conception. And eventually this was done in 1995 when the Association of Caribbean States was formed, and all the states of the Caribbean, including Cuba, became a member. But they tended to approach Cuba within the context of that broader need for preserving a Caribbean identity and to recognize Cuba as a legitimate Caribbean nation.
You're just about to head off to the funeral of the Guyanese president, Chetty Jagan. Can you make some comparisons between Chetty Jagan and Michael Manley?
Well, both of them, I think, represent the end of an era in that they are really the end of the line of the charismatic, old-style Caribbean liberators. Chetty Jagan was, from his writings and institutional affiliations, far more to the left than Michael Manley. While Michael Manley belonged to the grouping of social democratic parties, which included a number of ruling parties in Europe and were what we would call liberals within the United States, Chetty Jagan was different in that his party was a member of the International Alliance of Communist and Socialist Parties, and therefore he was strongly affiliated to the Moscow wing of Soviet socialism. He had a lot of problems in Guyana. There's definite evidence that there was an attempt to overthrow his government, which was successful. And in the end, he remained out of power from 1964 until 1992, when free and fair elections were held. In that period, so many changes had occurred in the world, and particularly the disintegration of the Soviet Union, that when he came to power in 1992, he, like Manley, adopted a very pro-market, pro-American set of policies. And I think that characterizes the nature of his rule right up until his death.
Would you say that the United States succeeded in both cases in getting their way, almost like in Haiti when Aristide returned after the coup, how he changed his policies?
Yeah, I think that in a general sense, America was successful in that what they wanted was governments that were not going to rock the boat in terms of American relations, governments that would be pro-American, governments that would be sympathetic to open markets and create an environment in which American capital would rule, and governments that would also toe the line in terms of the increasing U.S. concerns about security and stability among a large number of small states, which the Caribbean represents. So I think from that point of view, they were extremely successful. But I think that a lot of the success had to do not only with the efforts made by the Americans, and that was quite considerable. I don't want to underestimate that. But the governments themselves, I think, made misjudgments, maybe coming from inexperience, coming from the environment of being the first generation of really serious political leaders in the context of independence, and did not really involve the population seriously and systematically in their programs of political and social and economic advancement, so that different periods of time, for different reasons, they were put in positions where they seemed to be isolated from their popular bases, and the Americans, of course, exploited that.
We're just about to hear an excerpt of a speech from Michael Manley that he gave in the early 1970s on socialism. In the end, would you say that Michael Manley was no longer a socialist by his second term?
Well, it's hard to know what was in his mind, but certainly one can say that the environment in which he operated in his second term did not permit him to even ventilate the views of socialism as he was able to ventilate them in his first term, because the world had changed. And some of this change they tried to accommodate themselves to, and I think it's reflected in both the styles of their government, the language that they use in expressing their ideas, and then the concrete policies which they put in place within the Caribbean region.
What will you remember most, both about Michael Manley of Jamaica and Chetty Jagan of Guyana?
I think I remember most that they were fighters, and I think that they were committed, which is very different from the other types of leadership we've had within the region. I think they were genuinely committed to popular causes and to the popular masses. And I think for that reason alone, they will stand in a very high position of prominence in any history of the century in relationship to the Caribbean. I also believe that both of them had an important role to play in the wider international stage, ensuring that small countries could, in fact, even though they live within the backyard of the United States, have developed postures of defiance and independence.
Well, Dr. Clive Thomas, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Professor of Economics and Director of the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Guyana. And now we are going to turn to that excerpt of the speech by Michael Manley, given before the Jamaican Parliament in 1974, at the time when his government began adopting socialist policies in earnest.
Now, when you look at socialism and capitalism, these are perfectly clear distinctions. Now, the real problem arises this way. When you say private business, you are not referring to a system. Private business is not a philosophy. Private business is not a method of organizing society as a whole. Private business is a method of producing goods and services. It's a way of putting manpower and capital and management together to produce a particular article or supply a particular need. And therefore, what we say is that then this philosophical system, which we reject capitalism, is a totally different thing from private business. All is going to be set out very clearly in these papers that are coming next Tuesday. And I sum it up finally so that where private business is guided by purely capitalistic values, it has no place in a socialist Jamaica. Where, on the other hand, private business accepts the overriding needs of the community as being paramount, accepts the government as existing to interpret these needs, and is itself guided by a sense of social responsibility, that kind of business has a permanent and honorable place under socialism in Jamaica's future. My second comment is to do with insecurity, to do with insecurity. I know what uncertainties are felt by all sorts of people in today's world. Insecurity. But may I remind them that the insecurity which they feel now is as nothing compared with what is felt by the poor. I suggest that everybody in this country pause every now and again to imagine what it is like to wake up morning after morning with no job, not knowing how to pay for food on a Friday, no tea, not knowing where to turn to for the baby's milk, not knowing when the bailiff will appear. These are the terrible consequences that have been visited upon Jamaica by the capitalist system which has operated for so long and which every Jamaican must now work to change. Now, sir, one other thing, you know, that sometimes we get very confused about some of the statistics. And I'll just say one thing that I think that Jamaicans would do well to remember at this time. Again, looking at this difference between the value of property as central and the value of people as central. You know, sir, a figure that I
Michael Manley speaking before the Jamaican Parliament in 1974. Again, the former Prime Minister died on Thursday night after a long battle with cancer. He was 72 years old. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. Also, if you'd like to order that mug to be sent to the White House, the Coffee, Tea, and Me mug, you can call that number as well, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is engineered by Kenneth Mason, our executive producer, Julie Drizin. Thanks to Samori Marksman. And again, I'm going to give that number one more time because I know how many calls we're going to get for it. The number to call for a cassette or to send that mug to the White House is 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!